From WHYY in Philadelphia, Happy New Year. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we conclude our holiday series of music interviews with singer and songwriter Leonard Cohen. He'll read from his recent book of poems, talk about his songs, his Buddhist teacher, his rabbi grandfather, and more.
If you want a lover, I'll do anything you ask me to. And if you want another kind of love, I'll wear a mask for you. If you want a partner, take my hand. Or if you want to strike me down in anger, here I stand, I'm your man.
First the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Happy New Year. Today we're concluding our holiday series of music interviews with Leonard Cohen, a great songwriter who's incomparable when it comes to expressing despair and cynicism. At the same time, there's a romantic longing and a spiritual quality to many of his songs. As we'll hear, he spent 5 years in retreat at a Zen center. Cohen became famous in the late 60s and early 70s for songs like Suzanne, Bird on a Wire, and Famous Blue Raincoat. He published poems and novels before he started recording, and last May he published a collection of poems called Book of Longing. Many of them were written at the Zen Center. In 2006, a performance film was released called I'm Your Man, featuring several singers doing his songs. It recently came out on DVD. There was some not-so-good news in 2005. Cohen filed a lawsuit alleging that his former manager defrauded him of millions of dollars, leaving him with only $150,000. Although he won a multi-million-dollar settlement, it's unclear whether he'll be able to ever collect any of it. I spoke with Leonard Cohen in May and asked him to read a poem from Book of Longing. Part of this poem is also a song lyric.
I'll just start reading this poem. It's called Thousand Kisses Deep. It's a long poem. Some of it is just meant to be read. Some of it is meant to be sung. I'll start with two or three verses of the part that's meant to be read. You came to me this morning and you handled me like meat. You'd have to be a man to know how good that feels, how sweet. My mirror twin, my next of kin, I'd know you in my sleep, and who but you would take me in a thousand kisses deep. I loved you when you opened like a lily to the heat. See, I'm just another snowman standing in the rain and sleet, who loved you with his frozen love, his second-hand physique, with all he is and all he was, a thousand kisses deep. I know you had to lie to me, I know you had to cheat, to pose all hot and high behind the veils of sheer deceit. Our perfect porn aristocrat, so elegant and cheap. I'm old, but I'm still into that, a thousand kisses deep.
That's Leonard Cohen, and here he is singing the part that's meant to be sung.
I'm turning tricks, I'm getting fixed, I'm back on Boogie Street. You lose your grip, and then you slip into the masterpiece. And maybe I had miles to drive, promises to keep. You ditch it all to stay alive. A thousand kisses deep.
That's Leonard Cohen from his CD, 10 New Songs, and the poem is published in his new book, Book of Longing, which is a collection of his poems. Leonard Cohen, welcome to Fresh Air. It's so great to have you on the show. You know, there's the expression Boogie Street in that poem. What does Boogie Street mean to you?
Well, Boogie Street is what we're all doing. We're all on Boogie Street, and we believe that we leave it from time to time. We go up a mountain or into a hole, but most of the time we're hustling on Boogie Street one way or another.
Now you took a several-year long retreat from Boogie Street and went to a Zen center on the West Coast. And was it 5 years that you were there?
I was there 5 or 6 years, yes.
So you've been alternating, I guess, in your life between Boogie Street and meditation.
Well, actually, a monastery is just part of Boogie Street. On Boogie Street, you go back to your flat or your apartment, and you close the door, and you kind of eliminate the rest of the world. You kind of eliminate Boogie Street. So there's really more respite from Boogie Street on Boogie Street than there is in a monastery, because a monastery is designed to eliminate private space. There's a saying, like pebbles in a bag, the monks polish one another. So in that kind of situation, you're always coming up against someone else. So in a certain sense, coming up against someone else all the time is Boogie Street.
Well, that must be really hard. I mean, I think of you as a fairly... your reputation as being kind of solitary and reclusive. So we always think of you as being reclusive when you're at the Zen Center. Now you're saying it's actually, you're always in the company of other people.
Yes, you're all... It's designed to overthrow that appetite for privacy.
Now, you have this new book, and I think you're working on a forthcoming record. In part, the way I read it in the news stories, because while you were at the Zen Center for several years and your career was on hiatus, your manager swindled you out of millions of dollars and left you with very little.
Some guys have all the luck.
It seems like... it almost seems like a Zen cone or something, you know what I mean? You go to the Zen Center to, like, retreat from part of the world and, you know, the material world, and the material world is actually stolen from you while you're there.
That's true. It's enough to put a dent in your mood.
Well, did being at the Zen Center for that long help you deal with this?
I don't know what helped me deal with it. I don't... I guess it just hasn't hit me yet, but... It just happened, you know. I still was eating every day. There's still a roof over my head. You know, I don't have the savings or the, that kind of sense of security that I had before. But, you know, I live the same kind of life most of the time. And my son said something really wonderful to me. When this whole thing hit, he said, listen, Dad, do what you have to do, but don't do it for us, because we've had a great life and we can take care of ourselves. So they're really, you know, except for the hassle, you know, of dealing with lawyers and forensic accountants and tax specialists, the actual, you know, blow was not all that severe.
My guest is Leonard Cohen, and he has a new book of poems. It's called Book of Longing. Now, some of your poems have alternate lives as songs, like A Thousand Kisses Deep, which we opened with. And you've set poems by other poets to music, including one by Lord Byron. Is there much of a difference to you between a poem and a song lyric?
Well, there are certain poems that really do lie very gracefully on the page. For instance, to take an obvious example, if a poem by E. Cummings has a certain graceful display on the page, and some poems just naturally are meant to be absorbed in silence, where the tempo is decided on by the reader. And he could reverse it and forward it and linger. There are other kinds of lyrics that have their own metrical, imperial advice, and they invite you to move swiftly from line to line. And there are poems that are of mine that are always candidates for a song. Sometimes they don't make it, and sometimes they do.
Well, take a song like Famous Blue Raincoat. I think that is such an extraordinary lyric, and that it works as a poem. I mean, it's just so well written.
Some of them do. Some of them do.
Did you write that as a poem or as a song?
I wrote that as a song. But it's always the same for me, but it's only afterwards that I realize that I can... that it does arise with a melody, or sometimes it arises with a melody that doesn't work, or the other thing happens. You know, a melody and a lyric arises, but you know the lyric doesn't deserve that kind of expression, and you're left with a good tune.
Would you talk a little bit about writing the lyric for that song?
I don't know. I don't remember how it arose. I don't remember how any of them get written.
What about the image? Do you remember how you got the image of the famous blue raincoat torn at the shoulder?
Well, I had a blue raincoat. It was a Burberry, and it had lots of buckles and various fixtures on it. It was a very impressive raincoat. I'd never seen one like it. I think I bought it in London, and it always resided in my memory as some glamorous possibility that I never quite realized. So it began to stand for that unassailable romantic life, the opposite of a cloak of invisibility, the garment that would lead you into a marvelous erotic and intellectual adventures. So that's what the symbol was, I think.
That's great. And was there somebody like the character in the song who was almost like a brother to you and then betrayed you by becoming involved with your lover? I mean, is this a story or is it based on something that happened?
I always happened many times. I think that's happened to me a lot. It happens when one is in that that world. You know, fortunately, you know, I've been expelled from that particular dangerous garden, you know, by my age. So I'm not participating in these maneuvers with the frequency that I once did. But I think that when one is in that world, that you know, even if the situation does not result in any catastrophic splits, as it does in famous Berenko, one is always, you know, edging, and one is always protecting one's lover, and one is always, in a certain sense, on the edge of a jealous disposition.
Well, why don't we pause here, and soon we'll hear more of your poems, but let's hear one of your early songs, and this is Famous Blue Raincoat. My guest is Leonard Cohen.
Oh, the last time we saw you, you looked so much older. Your famous blue raincoat was torn at the shoulder. You'd been to the station to meet every train there. You came home without Lily Marlene, and you treated my woman to a flake of your life. And when she came back, she was nobody's wife. Well, I see you there with a rose in your teeth, one more thin gypsy thief. Well, I see Jane's away. She sends her regards.
That's Leonard Cohen singing his song, Famous Blue Raincoat. You know, before we heard that song, you said that you were kind of, what, exempt from that world of, like, sexual passion now and jealousy and all of that because
What is not exempt, but one is not, you know, because one is not as welcome
right
into the garden.
<That's>, it kind of reminds me of a line that you wrote that I really love from your song Tower of Song. You have mm-hmm. the line, "I ache in the places I used to play."
Yeah,
what a great line!
Yeah.
Is that something you sweated over, or did you just kind of get that?
Well, you get it, but you get it after sweating. In other words, you discard. I'm in the situation where I can't discard anything unless I finish it. So I have to finish the verses that I discard. So it takes a long time. I have to finish it to know whether it deserves to survive in the song. So in that sense, all the songs take a long time. And although the good lines come unbidden, they're anticipated, and the anticipation involves a patient application to the enterprise.
We'll talk more with Leonard Cohen after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Leonard Cohen. His recent book of poems is called Book of Longing. You seem driven by two opposing engines. You know, on the one hand, so many of your songs are about, you know, lusts and appetites and beauty and you know, seeking pleasure of various sorts. And at the same time, you've also devoted years of your life to meditation and the desire for some kind of transcendence. So, and also your songs make it clear that you're not unfamiliar with, you know, depression and regret and fear, which are, again, the kind of things that one tries to quiet through meditation. Did you become a Buddhist because your desires were so dominant?
Well, I never became a Buddhist, to tell you the truth.
Should I just use the word practicing meditation?
I bumped into a man many years ago who happened to be a Zen master. I wasn't looking for a religion. I had a perfectly good religion. I certainly wasn't looking for a new series of rituals or new scriptures or dogmas. You know, I wasn't looking for that. I wasn't looking for anything exalted or spiritual. I had a great sense of disorder in my life, of chaos, of depression, of distress. And I had no idea where this came from. And the prevailing psychoanalytic explanations at the time didn't seem to address the things I felt. So I had to look elsewhere, and I bumped into someone who seemed to be at ease with himself. It seems a simple thing to say. He seemed to be at ease with himself and at ease with others. And without ever deeply studying at the time what he was speaking about, it was the man himself that attracted me.
So this was your teacher. What kind of teacher? Is he still alive, I should ask first?
He's still alive. I just had tea with, well, it wasn't tea, it was liquor. I had a drink with him on his 99th birthday.
Whoa.
Which was last April the 21st, a lovely evening I spent with him.
How did you decide it was time for you to leave the Zen Center?
I don't know. I'm never sure why I do anything, tell you the truth. I don't know if I could tell you the whole story because it's very private, but I felt the reason I'd gone to see Roshi and had become a monk, it was appropriate to become a monk because if I was going to be in his scene, that was the uniform. As I've often said, if he had been a teacher of, you know, physics in Heidelberg, I would have learned German and studied physics in Heidelberg. So it was appropriate for me to become a monk. But the life is very rigorous. I mean, it's designed to overthrow a 21-year-old. So I was already in my, you know, 60s and late 60s. So there was that part of it, but I had the feeling that it wasn't doing any good, and it wasn't really addressing this real problem of distress, which seemed to be the background of all my feelings and activities and thoughts. So I began to feel that this is a lot of work for very little return. That was the kind of superficial feelings I had. There were other feelings that are ambiguous and too difficult to describe. They deserve or probably should be described in song or poetry rather than conversation.
Our interview with Leonard Cohen was recorded last May. We'll hear the rest of it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Oh, we're drinking and we're dancing, and the band is really happening, and the Johnny Walker wisdom running high. And my very sweet companion, she's the angel of compassion. She's rubbing up the world against her thigh. And every drinker, every dancer lifts a happy face to thank her. The fiddler fiddles something so sublime. All the women tear their blouses off, and the men they dance on the polka dots. And his partner found, and his partner lost, and it's hell to pay when the fiddler stops. It's closing time. And the polka dots, and its partner found, and its partner lost, and it's hell to pay when the fiddler stops.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Ovid's The Metamorphoses, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Leonard Cohen reads the lyrics to a song he hasn't yet recorded.
Well, my friends are gone and my hair is gray. I ache in the places where I used to play, and I'm crazy for love, but I'm not coming on. I'm just paying my rent every day in the Tower of Song. I said to Hank Williams, how lonely does it get? Hank Williams hasn't answered yet, but I hear him coughing all night long. Oh, 100 floors above me in the Tower of Song.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're concluding our holiday series of recent music interviews with Leonard Cohen, the songwriter, singer, poet, and novelist. I spoke with him last spring when his collection of poems, Book of Longing, was published. Many of them were written at a Zen monastery in California, where he lived for 5 years. I'd like you to read another poem from your book, Book of Longing. And this is called Titles. Would you tell us when you wrote this?
I've been writing it for a while, but I finished it last winter in Montreal, and there's a drawing of my house at the bottom of the page, and in that upper window is the window that I was looking out of when I finished the poem and wrote the last few lines, a third-story window overlooking the Parc de Portugal. It's a poem called Titles. I had the title poet, and maybe I was one for a while. Also, the title singer was kindly accorded me, even though I could barely carry a tune. For many years, I was known as a monk. I shaved my head and wore robes and got up very early. I hated everyone, but I acted generously, and no one found me out. My reputation as a ladies' man was a joke. It caused me to laugh bitterly through the 10,000 nights I spent alone. From a third-story window above the Parc de Portugal, I've watched the snow come down all day. As usual, there's no one here. There never is. Mercifully, the inner conversation is canceled by the white noise of winter. I am neither the mind, the intellect, nor the silent voice within. That's also canceled. And now, gentle reader, in what name, in whose name, do you come to idle with me in these luxurious and dwindling realms of aimless privacy?
That's a great poem. That's Titles from Leonard Cohen's new collection of poems, The Book of Longing, or Book of Longing. I just particularly like the part because I think this is really funny. I hated everyone, but I acted generously, and no one found me out.
It's true, huh?
And that was in the monastery that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's not the whole story, but it's enough of the story to justify the line.
I want to talk with you a little bit how your voice has changed over the years. When you started performing, you had a much kind of, you know, clearer and higher voice. Your voice has deepened and roughened over the years. And we can hear it when you speak. You can hear it in your records from the late 80s on. Has that changed because of cigarettes? Or
well, about, you know, 500 tons of whiskey and, you know, a million cigarettes, 50, 60 years of smoking. But I don't smoke anymore.
What? How'd you stop?
I had my throat examined. I was having trouble getting the smoke down, you know, so I thought I'd better have my throat examined. And, you know, it's a very disagreeable procedure. They put a little camera up your nose and down your throat. You know, the doctor looked there. There was a scowl on his face. And actually, he put my throat up on a screen. Well, I couldn't really quite follow. Ooh, it didn't look that interesting. But I said, well, okay, do I have it? And he said, no, but you're on the Royal Road. So I thought I'd better give up the smokes.
How hard was it?
It's getting harder now. It's been about 5 years. You're never really cured of that addiction, I guess, because now I notice when someone lights up, I have a special interest that I thought I no longer had.
When you were growing up, you came from a family that had a kind of deeply religious background. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think your maternal grandfather was a rabbi, and your paternal grandfather was very active in the Jewish community.
Yes, I came of a very conservative, what they call traditional rather than orthodox. It's an expression of Judaism that looks towards orthodoxy but doesn't quite embrace it. But it was a thoroughly Jewish home and a fairly good education. But But my mother's father was a great scholar. He was known as the Prince of Grammarians, and he wrote a lexicon of Hebrew homonyms and a thesaurus of Talmudic interpretation. And my father's father was a very competent community organizer and founded a number of organizations that still exist and around which much of the Jewish community in Montreal was organized.
Were they teacher figures for you when you were a boy?
Not so much. My grandfather, my mother's father, who lived with us just before he died, he was senile at the time. And he was a very warm figure who, went slowly mad in the house. So an impressive figure. I'd like to write about him one day, but I haven't. But not real influences in my work. But as men, of course they had some influence on me.
So it was one of your grandfathers that went mad?
Well, my mother's father became increasingly senile as he lived with us.
I see.
And he'd come into the kitchen and he had a cane and he'd set the cane on the edge of the table and he'd just sweep everything off of it, and say, someone's stolen my watch, and then he'd defecate in the hallway and wipe himself with a curtain. So it became very distressing, especially for my mother.
Yeah, and to see somebody who'd been like this, rabbi.
Well, my mother said, people came from 100 miles around to hear him speak when he was the principal of a yeshiva in Lithuania.
Did you ever, when you were young, expect to seriously study Judaism?
I would like to study Judaism. I feel that my own Jewish education was really quite superficial from a certain point of view, although I think the values were very clear and were presented very clearly. There were aspects of the whole tradition that were not emphasized, and I've come to those areas myself as I've grown older, but I would like to go deeper.
My guest is Leonard Cohen. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter and singer Leonard Cohen. His recent book of poems is called Book of Longing. Do you feel, as a songwriter, do you feel a connection to, say, Irving Berlin, Cole Porter, Harold Arlen, those guys, the kind of classic American popular songwriters?
Oh, well, I think they're better than I am. I just think they know more about music. Someone like Cole Porter's rhymes are much, much more elegant than mine. I have a very, very limited, a very limited kind of expression. But I've done the best that I can with it, and I've worked it as diligently as I can. But I don't really, except for one or two songs, maybe like Hallelujah, or If It Be Your Will. I think those are probably my two best songs. I don't think I rise to the level of those great songwriters.
It's funny, you have one recording of Irving Berlin's song Always, and the last few lines are a lyric that you added of your own.
Right.
And it's such a sweet song, I'll be loving you always with a love that's true always. you know, not just for an hour, not just for a day, you know, not for just a minute.
It's such a beautiful song.
But your last few lines take this, you know, really lovely, sweet song, and suddenly it's like really dark and sour.
You can depend on me for that.
Exactly. I'm just going to recite your last few lines, if you don't mind.
Sure, I don't remember them.
Not for just a second or a minute or an hour, not just for the weekend and a shakedown in the shower, not just for the summer and the winter going sour, but always.
That's good.
It's great.
That's really good.
When I hear that, I think of you almost as having sat down and said, Irving Berlin is great. This is one of the differences between me and him in our sensibilities.
Well, of course, the treatment of the song, you know, is so very different. I think I changed the tempo, too. I think his is 3-4, and I changed it to 4-4 and, you know, brought in a completely different kind of, and a kind of drunken version of it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And do you think that you are more kind of cynical in some of your songwriting than any of those kind of classic guys could ever be?
You know, that's a question I've just been asking myself in the past few days, because somehow I've heard Louis Armstrong's "What a Wonderful World It Could Be." Every turn I hear it for some odd reason. It's such a very beautiful song. And I think to myself, you know, why don't I leave a couple of songs like that behind me, you know? And I'd like to, you know, there's a lot of things I'd like to do. But when you're actually in the trenches and, you know, you're in front of the page or, you know, the guitar or the keyboard under your hands, you know, you have to deal with where the energy is, you know, what arises, what presents itself with a certain kind of urgency. So in those final moments, you really don't choose. You just you go where the smoke is and the flames and the glow or the fire. You know, you just go there.
I want to play one of your very cynical songs, and it's one of my favorites of yours, and it's Everybody Knows from your 1988 album, I'm Your Man. And, I mean, to get this song at its really full cynicism, there's a movie called Exotica from 1994 in which, by Adam McGuigan, in which, like, a young teenage girl has this set piece that she dances all the time at a strip club, and she's always dressed as, like, a schoolgirl in, like, the pleated skirt and the button-down shirt, and she strips to your song Everybody Knows. Before we hear it, would you talk a little bit about writing it?
I wrote it with Sharon Robertson, mm-hmm. a woman with whom I've collaborated on many songs. I don't really remember. See, if I really remembered the conditions which produce good songs, I'd try to establish them. So I don't really know. Most of them, you know, begin on napkins or in the notebook that I, you know, carry around with me all the time. And I wanted to write a tough song. You know, I had the feeling that, you know, I was Humphrey Bogart or some. I began it in France, in Paris, at a cafe in the 14th arrondissement. And, you know, I don't know who I thought I was at the time, but it was, you know, somebody who you couldn't put anything over on. I think that was the mood, you know. I'm a guy, well, you know, I'm incredibly gullible in my ordinary civilian life, but as I was sitting there, I was the guy that you couldn't put anything over on.
Well, here's Everybody Knows, Leonard Cohen, recorded in 1988.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows.
We'll talk more with Leonard Cohen after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the songwriter and singer Leonard Cohen. I want to ask you a couple of questions about beauty. There's something very vexing about beauty when it comes to people. You know, you don't need to be told about the pleasures of being the presence of beauty and how attractive, beautiful people are. But when it comes to physical beauty, that can also sometimes be a superficial beauty, yet you can, some people almost become like a slave to it, to either embodying it or being attached to somebody who does. In your song Chelsea Hotel, there's a few lines that go, excuse me for kind of ruining your lines by quoting them, but
you don't ruin them.
You're right. You told me again you preferred handsome men, but for me you would make an exception. And clenching your fist for the ones like us who were oppressed by the figures of beauty, you fixed yourself. You said, well, never mind, we are ugly, but we have the music. Do you think of yourself as being someone who has been oppressed by the figures of beauty?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's no question about that. I still am. You know, I still stagger and fall. Of course, I have that. It just happens to me all the time. And, you know, you just have to get very careful about it, because it's inappropriate for an elderly chap to register, you know, authentically his feelings, you know, because they really can be interpreted. So you have to get quite covert as you get older, you know, or you have to find some avuncular way, you know, of responding. But still, you just really are just, you're wounded, you stagger, and you fall.
In the song, you know, the character says to the singer, we are ugly, but we have the music. And the character says to you that they preferred handsome men, but for you, they would make an exception. So if you don't see yourself as physically beautiful, what has it been like to feel like you're a slave to beauty, yet feel that you don't embody that yourself?
Well, I've asked this question to a lot of people that are, you know, certifiably beautiful, who don't feel that they're beautiful. I think this is it's a platitude, but it's a common experience. So I don't think anybody beats the rap in this realm. So we all feel when we're loved that some concession has been made, and you know, we probably, none of us deserve the love that we expect. So when it comes to us, we can legitimately understand it as an exception to the rule.